Welcome to the fourth and final event in the 2011 The Nature of Things Lecture Series. I'm Lisa Thompson, the Public Programs Manager at the Utah Museum of Natural History, and I want to welcome you all here this evening to the Salt Lake City Main Library Auditorium. We'd also like to welcome the audiences listening tonight on KCPW Public Radio, 88.3 and 105.3 FM. This is the fifth year of the Nature of Things Lecture Series. Over the past 4 years, the museum has been pleased to present biologist E.O. Wilson, journalist Michael Pollan, global commentator Thomas Friedman, and public activist Robert Kennedy Jr., along with many other fascinating scientists, writers, and policymakers. Our theme this year is Reinventing Energy. In this forward-looking, action-oriented series, we are pleased to present our keynote speaker, Environmental Defense Fund President Fred Krupp, Utah State University Energy Dynamics Laboratory Director Jeff Moose, Jonathan Huckstra, a senior scientist at the Nature Conservancy, and tonight, we're excited to change things up a bit with a panel discussion that will explore Utah's clean energy frontline. Before we get the discussion started, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the support of our sponsors and partners. For the fifth year in a row, the Nature of Things series is underwritten by a generous gift from the R. Harold Burton Foundation. This support enables the museum to offer events like this one tonight for free or at low cost to the community. We'd also want to thank our media partner, KCPW 88.3 FM, for getting the word out to the community and for ensuring that people who can't physically attend the event are able to participate through the live broadcasts and the podcasts. Additionally, we'd like to acknowledge the Rio Tinto, Kennecott, Utah Copper, the Nature Conservancy, the Castle Foundation, and the Leonardo for their valuable support. There are numerous other community partners who contribute to the program, and I refer you to the lecture handout for a list of those in our community who help make this lecture series possible. A special thanks goes out to the Salt Lake County Zoo Arts and Parks Fund. These are funds that you approve as voters and to provide cultural and educational programming throughout our county. Thank you very much. Tonight, we're going to zoom in for a local perspective on the larger questions we have looked into in the first three lectures of this year. We've invited a panel of local experts, all of who work in the energy field, to give us a report from the front lines of Utah's clean energy development. We will discuss Utah's clean energy assets and challenges, learn about innovative projects, large and small, and find out how we can get involved in shaping a clean energy future for our state. I'd like to turn the floor over now to tonight's panel moderator, KCPW News Director Jeff Robinson. Thank you so much for being here, Jeff, and leading this discussion.
And thanks to the Utah Museum of Natural History for presenting tonight's finale of the 2011 Nature of Things Lecture Series. Our panelists tonight represent a broad range of groups, including local governments, the state, a utility, a developer, and the nonprofit sector as well. By the way, KCBW is in the middle of our spring membership drive, so if you'd like to help us keep live broadcasts like the Nature of Things Lecture Series on the air here in Salt Lake City, consider going online and making a pledge at kcpw.org. Let me start by introducing each of our panelists this evening and having them take 2 to 3 minutes to explain what organization they represent and how it's involved in clean energy in Utah. We'll start out with Vicki Bennett, Sustainability Director for Salt Lake City. Vicki, tell us about the city's efforts to further clean energy in Utah.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, Salt Lake City really has the advantage of being the governmental entity that we consider, you know, city governments are closest to the citizen. And what we do is really work on reaching out to the citizens. We have various methods where we try and educate them on their opportunities, and we also have a large ordinance rewrite project going on to promote sustainability, and especially, you know, some of that includes clean energy options. We want to make sure that we're eliminating as many obstacles as possible to allow people to put clean energy on their homes and businesses. Another thing that we're just about done with and we'll be bringing out in the next month or so is we have just finished what we're calling our community carbon footprint. And that is a wonderful collaborative effort that many of the people here on this panel have worked on with us to look at where are the carbon emissions coming from, where are our major uses of energy, and what can we do to really set some goals and find some ways to reduce that. And, of course, reducing it's going to be much more than just what the city can do, but what we all individually, businesses and others, can do to work together. So that's most of how we're involved in all of this.
Thank you, Vicki, and we're also pleased to be joined by James Campbell, Senior Environmental Policy and Strategy Analyst for Rocky Mountain Power and PacifiCorp. James, tell us what PacifiCorp is doing to bring clean energy to Utah.
Well, thanks. What we are doing, we're consistently providing safe and reliable energy, and we're doing it at a cost-effective manner. I often get asked, how is it that we make that determination on what are the energy generation sources we select? That is, what are the power plants we decide to construct? And what we do is we do a process called the Integrated Resource Plan. That process is a public process, so anybody here is welcome to participate in that. And during that process, we work with our government regulators, and we evaluate all of the different generation technologies that are available. We also do predictive models to look at what would be our load demands. That is, how much power will our customers demand? How much energy will you guys consume? And then what we do is we take that information, we conduct sophisticated models, and from that we select what is the least cost, least risk. And during that process, at least in the last 5 years, that has come up with significant amounts of wind energy. We have constructed over 1,000 megawatts that we own. We have also purchased through contracts another 600 megawatts of wind. This has led Rocky Mountain Power, PacifiCorp, to be the second largest owner of wind of any utility in the country. It also means we have about three times the national average. That amount, that 1,600 megawatts of energy, produces a generating capability of about 500,000 homes. So this is significant. It's real. It's not greenwashing. It is real energy going into people's homes. And but that's what we've done up to today and up to 2010. The next challenge is, as our population continues to grow, is how are we going to meet the needs in the future? And so, again, we use this integrated resource planning process to make that determination. And right now we're looking at, again, out into the future, doing even more amounts of wind energy. We're also looking at putting in low carbon emitting natural gas and significant amounts of energy efficiency. And that's the energy efficiency is the part where you all can come into this process. And that will, we are spending about $100 million a year in trying to encourage our customers to use less, which a friend of mine in business thinks that's kind of a strange thing, to get your customers to buy less of your product. But the cheapest resource is the resource that the energy not used. So that is what we're doing right now, and we are, again, as part of that process, we do continually look and evaluate as technologies develop. And so if other newer, cleaner energies, technologies do come on the scene, we'll integrate those in.
Thank you, James. Also joining us this evening is Ann Ober, Intergovernmental Affairs Specialist for Salt Lake County. Ann, tell us a little bit about the county's efforts when it comes to clean and green energy.
Sure. So my job is under Mayor Peter Caroon, and the mayor has been focused on renewable energy and energy efficiency for the past 6 years. I want to put a little plug into the efficiency comments that James was saying earlier, because efficiency really is the first step towards what we're trying to achieve. So the county's been working on multiple projects to reduce our load to begin with. So the first thing is that we are currently upgrading all of our facilities to be more energy efficient. And then we are also building LEED buildings whenever we build a new facility. Our new rec center in Harriman is built to LEED Gold. And we are currently looking at some facilities that have achieved or will achieve LEED Platinum. So we're very excited about our buildings. And then we're also looking at moving to the next step, which would be to a net zero building. Right now, we're considering that for our DA building that we will have to build in the next couple of years. And it's a great opportunity to integrate both efficiency and renewable energy. So about 5 years ago, we started working on solar power projects. The mayor started considering ways that we might be able to integrate renewable energy to our portfolio. We started small with a blue sky purchase, as many of us do, and we grew from there. And at this point, we have several small installations on county facilities. We have a small installation on the planetarium, one on our new public works facility. We also have one at the Salt Palace. And we're about to go a whole lot bigger. So we are just now finishing signing all our documents to build a very large installation at the Salt Palace. We're expecting that that's going to be approximately 2.5 megawatts, which is huge. And then we are also doing a couple of additional small facilities, our environmental health facility, and then also a senior center. We have some great partners, and we're just working on those documents right now. I see one of our partners in the room, so thank you to Bella Energy for their partnership. But we're excited about this opportunity, and it's going to mean a great deal to Salt Lake County. The other piece that we've focused on is geothermal. We've been building out LEED facilities, as I've talked about, and we're doing small geothermal installations at several of those small facilities. The biggest one and most recent was out in our Magna Senior Center. We're also looking at building one in our Mill Creek facility that's under construction right now, and then looking at our Draper facility. We're excited about all of these opportunities. We wish we could do more wind in the valley, but unfortunately there's not a great location with county facilities for doing wind. So we'll keep buying blue sky where we can, and we're excited to encourage further renewable development wherever possible.
Also joining us tonight is Chris Tallickson, Program Manager for the Utah State Energy Program. Chris, tell us about the Utah State Energy Program and what your mission is.
The Utah State Energy Program is the primary conduit in the state for federal funding for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects in the state. Through that funding, our office does program design and management, helps deliver information and outreach for across the spectrum of renewable energy and energy efficiency projects at utility scale, distributed scale, in the residential, commercial, and industrial sectors. Fittingly, our office is mostly federally funded. We're part of the only Department of Energy cost-shared formula grant that provides discretionary funding to states for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. Our largest project underway right now relates to the stimulus bill, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, passed in 2009, which channeled $48 million through our office into renewable energy and energy efficiency projects. We're in the process of working with about 80 different partners under over 100 different contracts to deliver projects across the spectrum of energy efficiency and renewable energy in the state. And we're about 30 to 35% of the way through having spent those funds. So when you think of where is the stimulus funding gone, it's at work in Utah working on renewable energy and energy efficiency. And we still have a ways to go, but there's a lot of activity related to that. We also perform information gathering functions related to renewable energy resource identification. We have a publication that's available on our website, Utah's Energy Landscape, which gives a great comprehensive description of all of Utah's energy resources, both conventional and renewable.
Thank you, Chris. And we have on our panel tonight Piper Rhodes, Manager for Sustainable Development, Health, Safety, and Environment at Kennecott Land. Piper, tell us a bit about what Kennecott is doing when it comes to clean energy.
So when it comes to clean energy at Daybreak, the one thing I always think about is the USGBC says 39% of all of the energy used in the United States is used in buildings. So one of the first things that you need to consider when you're going to do a large-scale development like Daybreak is think about how energy efficiency and what you can do from an energy efficiency perspective within your buildings. Daybreak is a sustainably developed community where people can choose to live, work, and play. We have a series of sustainable development guidelines that builders who choose to partner with us have to comply with. One of the first things that we actually worked with our builders to do back in 2004 was to get them to build to ENERGY STAR standards within Daybreak. And now we're actually having every single home within Daybreak is certified to ENERGY STAR. And we also have a builder who we've worked pretty extensively with who now builds a solar standard residential production built home. That's a pretty big effort to undertake, and they've been able to achieve that and are extremely successful at it. From a commercial building standpoint, we've committed to building LEED commercial facilities. We actually built the first LEED Platinum building in the state of Utah. That building avoids about 30% of the energy of a similar size building of similar age that would have traditionally just been built to code. And that's just talking on the energy front. We also, similar to what Anne was saying, was we started out with Blue Sky. We've been a Blue Sky visionary partner for a number of years now. And we also partner with Salt Lake County, Salt Lake City on the Solar Salt Lake project, where we have a number of smaller solar installations within Daybreak and across our property, as well as some geo-exchange heat pump systems and our first wind turbine. One other thing to think about when you're talking about energy and clean energy future is building in transportation options when it comes to developing. So within Daybreak, one of the very first things that we tried to do was establish a master plan that provided for transportation options. So access to a series of trails, access to light rail, access to bus, mass transit, and then also the use of your car.
And finally, we're pleased to have Sarah Wright, Executive Director for Utah Clean Energy. Sarah, tell us about your organization.
I'm happy to. Thank you for having me here tonight. Utah Clean Energy, we are a solution-based organization, and we're really working to create a clean energy economy in Utah. And one of the things that we should think about, or maybe I hate to put a damper on the evening, but the United States is falling behind on clean energy. We used to be first a few years ago. China moved ahead of us in 2009. Germany moved ahead of us last year. Utah is sort of following a similar trend. I'm not sure if we were ever ahead, but our neighbors are moving quickly, surpassing Utah's investments in clean energy. So what we'd really like to see is our organization puts a lot of effort on the policy and regulatory framework so that we can create a playing field where energy efficiency and renewables can compete. We've worked on rules such as net metering that allows residential customers and businesses to put solar on their house and generate their own energy. And then maybe aside from James, I may be one of the few people here that stay up at night thinking about how utility resource decisions are made. But we spend a lot of time with the Utah Public Service Commission and utility regulators because utility regulators and the Public Service Commission, they're sort of the court and the jury. They help make decisions and are a gatekeeper for what resources are added to utilities, how much renewables they add, how much efficiency they add. But the catch is that they can only make decisions based on the evidence that's put before them. And so a big part of our job is to bring forth evidence and bring forth experts that can provide the Public Service Commission with the information they need to make sound decisions. Our goal is really to create a regulatory framework that adequately values the clean and renewable and risk-mitigating nature of renewable energy and energy efficiency, and a regulatory framework that rewards utilities like PacifiCorp for making those investments and make those utilities want to invest in renewables and efficiency over their traditional fossil resources. And I guess I might close with that we really believe that it's a collaborative and a creative process, and that citizen involvement and industry and partnerships is really the way that we are going to move forward so that we don't keep falling behind, and that we can do this to create a robust, not only a robust economy, but also to address one of our most pressing issues, climate change. So we don't think that it's an either-or proposition. We think that we can have a robust economy and address these critical issues.
Thank you, Sarah. You're listening to a panel discussion on clean energy in Utah, part of the Nature of Things lecture series brought to you by the Utah Museum of Natural History and broadcast live on 88.3 and 105.3 FM, NPR Utah, KCPW. Later in the hour, we'll take questions from our audience, but first, I have a series of questions for tonight's panelists on the state of clean energy in Utah. Let's try to aim for about 5 to 6 minutes of discussion on each question, and whoever wants to start off can just jump right in. The first question is, what assets, whether they're geographic, climatic, natural resources, economic, or political, does Utah have that will help us develop a clean energy economy?
Well, I'll start by saying that Utah is blessed with a very diverse makeup of energy resources, and the governor's office has done an analysis of this through the Utah Renewable Energy Zone process. And I actually brought some numbers if you're curious, but we probably have, if you look at the best wind resources, we have about 1,800 megawatts that could be developed, the best resources. And that's also, there are new wind turbines that are about 10% more efficient now that make that even a better resource. We have, I think, around, Chris, you can correct me, around 600 megawatts of potential for geothermal, 400 to 600 megawatts of geothermal. And with solar, a vast resource, much more than would ever be developed, but we have a huge potential for solar development. And then, as James mentioned, we also have the potential for energy efficiency is... we could easily, not easily because we have to have the political will and the public knowledge, but we could flatline our energy growth, and that's one of the things that's leading to the rate increases. If we were very aggressive at retrofitting our existing buildings, following the path of Daybreak and building very efficient new homes. So I think that that's another, those sort of, if we had the political will and the knowledge and involved citizens, I think that we could capitalize on all those resources.
You know, I would add another kind of asset that we have in the state, and that's human, which is that we have excellent universities here, and really to truly develop a green, clean economy, we're going to have to make significant strides in technology. And so we're going to have to rely on the experts in the that are coming out of the University of Utah, Utah State University, BYU, Weber State. And it's those individuals where we have to figure out a means how to harness that and really direct those expertise. And I think Utah is positioned nicely to do that. And so I would add that as human is another significant asset.
On that note, I would also say that Salt Lake County has a great relationship with USU Extension Services, and one of the projects that we're currently working on is a biofuels program that would actually use safflower oil instead of other bios for fueling our vehicles. The great thing with safflower is that we're looking at doing it with zero water or zero portable water, I should say, used to grow the product, which is a great opportunity in a desert like Utah to develop a biofuel that can be used readily throughout our state. So it is happening locally. We are finding entrepreneurs in our academia who are really leading the way, and I think it's a great asset, as James stated.
Okay, I was just going to plug the city and the county as well.
Well, I'll plug the state a little bit then. You mentioned political will, and the formation of Governor Herbert's new Office of Energy Development will include the state energy program and its focus on renewable energy and energy efficiency. So I'm very excited about the prospects of being having those two sectors included in and unified in the perspective and policy decisions going forward related to energy development in the state.
Okay, so we've talked about the assets. Let's flip the coin over and talk about the barriers, the challenges, again, when it comes to economic issues, geographic and political as well.
Well, this is James. I guess I'll start on that one.
Sure.
The biggest barrier to really clean energy is economic. And it's, to be blunt, it's more expensive than the existing generations that we have. It's more expensive than the fossil fuels, although new generation of fossil fuels, particularly coal, what we found in our IRP process is that there are some renewable technologies that can be competitive, and particularly wind, especially if we can find a wind resource that's excellent, like what we've been able to do. Unfortunately, those wind resources are located in Wyoming, because as anybody who's been to Wyoming knows, it's very windy. So the challenge is really going to be, how can we bridge that gap between the benefit that we have right now in the state of Utah, which is we have pretty cheap power. We're among the lowest in the country, so that is an asset. That's a benefit to drive our economy. So how do we bridge that gap between that cheap power and then bringing in really the generation resources of the future? And so how do we do that? And that's, I think, is the biggest hurdle.
I can speak from a residential perspective. I think one of the biggest barriers, again, is also cost. And when we talked about energy efficiency earlier, it makes the most sense to invest in energy efficiency measures within the residential marketplace first, and then look at how you could supplement that with a renewable energy technology. And sometimes it gets to the point at which investing in energy efficiency makes the most sense from a residential product perspective.
Anyone want to address the political challenges?
I guess that's my job. You know, I will say the political challenges, a lot of it relates to misinformation. I think that not everyone is as sophisticated as James and the utilities that realize that wind is reaching, it is basically at market parity right now with natural gas, but the difference is that you put in a wind plant and you know what you're paying for that power for 20 years. You don't know what you're paying for power if you put in a natural gas plant. And I think that there's also an idea that renewables are not ready for market or that we need storage, even though there's been numerous national and global studies that have looked at integration of wind and other renewables that show that you can do 20 to 30%, and I think Utah's at 3% now. So we have a long way to go before we get to any sort of issues on integrating variable resources. So there's a lot of misconceptions. I also believe that because renewables solve environmental issues, at the same time they're an economic tool and an energy tool, I think that often policymakers sort of put them in the camp that, oh, this is an environmental thing, this isn't an energy thing, this isn't an economic development thing. So I think that we just need to continue to educate our policymakers. And I do think that projects such as the Milford Wind Farm, they see it in their community, they see it generating electricity and generating income. So I'm hopeful that we can continue to educate our policymakers and that all of you and the industries, Rocky Mountain Power has been engaged, I think, in educating them and giving presentations. But renewables are ready for market now. They're the fastest growing energy resource in the world, and we just need to figure that out here.
I would also just add that there's a culture need that we need to work on. And it's not about being in Utah. It's just about making a change in the way we receive our energy. I think there's still a barrier to people that it's supposed to just come easily from the utility, and it's supposed to always be there, and it's supposed to be this constant that they don't have to think about. And you have to think about renewable energy. You have to think about it a lot. You have to make sure that your interconnection agreement's done, and you have to make sure that and you have to spend upfront time. You have to invest money. You have to build it yourself in some cases. So I think there's just some ease that comes with status quo that you need to work on to to face some of those barriers. Another example is with historical districts, where we have a hard time getting installations of solar into historical districts where they may not meet the regulations of the historical district. So there are little barriers at the local government level that we can work on, which we are working on with Vicki's help. But there's also a mindset shift that needs to take place.
I'd like to add, when it comes to looking at that shift, it's really looking at not just what's the cost of energy today, but let's look at what the cost of energy is going to be in the future. Because we all know it's going up, it's some of the numbers we've heard, and it comes straight from PacifiCorp. It's possibly up to 6% a year. This is going to continue. I mean, energy is not going to get cheaper. If we can lock in the price of energy today by having some clean energy, for example, solar or wind, you know what your price of energy is going to be for the next 20 years. You've really reduced your risk. So I think we need to look at some of the true long-term risk issues more thoroughly as we're considering what type of energy we're going to look for in the future.
So let's talk about specific projects here now. What are the most promising clean energy projects in Utah today?
I'm going to give myself a big push, I think, in this moment. As I mentioned earlier in our discussion, this is Ann Ober with Salt Lake County, and we are looking at doing a very large installation on our Salt Palace Convention Center. With one installation, we will more than double the amount of solar in the state of Utah at this point. So this is a great opportunity. We're very excited. Depending on how big we end up with our system, it's going to be one of the largest roof mount systems in the United States. And that puts us on the map, and it gets people talking about Utah again in regards to renewable energy. And we really have been focused on how do we help break barriers by moving government forward. We can't always force a culture change, but we can make changes and make decisions differently at the county. And that's what we've chosen to do, is we have chosen to put our money where our mouth is and find a way to do this in a cost-effective manner, and we've been successful, and we're very excited.
Just to echo and to Trump Ann and what the county's doing, I know at Rocky Mountain Power we're very strong supporters of this project, and we think this is a great project. And adding in 2 megawatts of solar in downtown is going to really give us a great opportunity to learn also how to integrate this stuff. And when what happens when a cloud goes by and all of a sudden 2 megawatts go down, and so how do we integrate that in? So this is a great project to help us get prepared for that future. Because I think the writing's on the wall in the sense of most of us can anticipate that solar is going to be part of that equation. It's not a significant part right now, but it will in the future. And so when does that future begin? And so it's nice that this kind of a project lets that future begin now.
And I'll just say that this project, as much as James and I are talking about it as ours, really is the entire panels project. We've all been involved in the Solar America Cities program through Salt Lake City. We could not have gotten to this point without some federal investment and without some state help and without the utilities help and without Utah Clean Energy and without Rio Tinto's support. So as much as it's Salt Lake County's installation, I think every person at this table really can take a big applause for all their work and dedication to the project.
And we really are all learning from each other, because now Salt Lake City is in the process of designing our public safety building, and that will be being built in the next 2 years. And we are designing that as a net zero building, and it will be the first net zero public safety building in the nation. And that will include, the actual design is going to make a building that requires half the amount of energy just as a basis, and then the energy that we do require we'll be looking at most likely solar, and we'll be seeing if there's other renewables that we can apply to it. But we do have quite a plan for solar panels on the building and off-site also.
You're listening to a panel discussion on clean energy in Utah, part of the Nature of Things lecture series from the Utah Museum of Natural History, and broadcast live on 88.3 and 105.3 FM, NPR Utah, KCBW. By the way, KCBW is in the middle of our spring membership drive, so if you'd like to help us keep live broadcasts like the Nature of Things lecture series on the air, consider going online and making a pledge at kcbw.org. Well, we've talked about how all of your organizations are contributing to a clean energy economy in Utah, but let's focus now on what private citizens can do and what help is available, be it from the business community or from city, county, and the state government, to further the state's efforts at clean energy. What can Utahns, everyday Utahns, do?
Well, our office at the State Energy Program fields, last year we fielded about 7,600 calls from the public asking exactly that question. And there are great resources out there to help educate yourself on ways to finance your project. One site called Desire, D-S-I-R-E USA, gives a comprehensive listing of incentives that are available for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. I live in Logan, and there's a second step would be to engage with your utility and take advantage of all opportunities you have to communicate your interests in energy-related matters to them. The Logan Power and Light has a 23% renewable energy portfolio in their portfolio mix, and they have a very active advisory committee that works with them on renewable energy and energy efficiency projects.
I think, too, some things that the average citizen can do is both utilities as well as the county have programs where you can have someone come out and take a look at your home and help you look for energy efficient improvements, and even in some circumstances help you fund those energy efficiency improvements in your home. And as we all sort of mentioned earlier, one of the best, freest forms of clean energy technology is having an efficient building or efficient home to live in.
And just to give a little bit more information about the county program, we received some funding under the stimulus money to do a home loan program as well. We've been running through those funds. We've actually finished off all of our grant options that we have, and now we're providing loans to some individuals who are still interested in making retrofits to their homes. Because of the success of this program, the county is actually looking at an opportunity for working with a private bank in order to increase the number of loans that would be used in our communities. Our hope is that that extension, if we're able to do it, will happen sometime late summer, early fall. So we strongly encourage homeowners who are interested in securing money through a interest rate that they can afford with a local bank to keep watching the county website. We're excited about the program, and we're expecting it to take off in the next few months.
You know, the biggest thing that the private citizen can do is really their behavior. And I think when you talk about clean energy and a clean energy economy, you have to incorporate not just the electricity component, but all forms of energy and how all forms of energy are used. And for most people, their single largest carbon footprint is going to be their car and transportation. And transportation is the biggest cause of pollution along the Wasatch Front. And so I think it's important that everybody really takes ownership for that. Myself and everybody else needs to really be aware that our behavior makes a difference. And it can cause either pollution, or we can make behavioral decisions that can make significant improvements.
Go ahead, Sarah.
To speak
to Ann's point about whole home retrofits, if you're not in Salt Lake County, the state of Utah is also managing a pilot program called Utah Home Performance that delivers the same sorts of incentives for energy efficiency upgrades.
And in addition to all the wonderful energy efficiency upgrades that you can do at home, a lot of people say, well, what do I do next? And I think if you can get involved in policy making, or I don't think that the Office of Consumer Service or the Division of Public Utilities or the Public Service Commission hear from very many citizens. And I think that we have their website, how to contact them on our website. But if you even just send letters and emails letting them know that you aren't necessarily concerned with just the cheapest electricity, but you want a long-term sustainable energy future, a cleaner energy future. So weighing in with regulators and weighing in with your policymakers, you know, we've seen with the grandma that it makes a big difference. So that's just one more step to take.
So as the nation sluggishly recovers from the economic downturn, there's been a lot of talk on the national level of so-called green-collar jobs. Whoever's familiar with the state of green jobs in Utah, talk about, you know, where are we seeing opportunities for people who want to get into this sector?
The state energy program, we're seeing a lot of interest from contractors who are moving into the whole home energy efficiency retrofit marketplace with gusto. We have, for our pilot program, which is small, we have 50 contractor partners signed up that are out doing assessments on homes and delivering whole home retrofit energy upgrades. So the contractors are figuring out it's a great complement to what they do in the building sector and that there is profit to be made.
Can I add that the state of Utah has received, they received $4.6 million from the Workforce Services, and there are a number of educational programs that they're working on to sort of educate these for these green-collar jobs, or I also like to say green-collar careers, because there is a long-term, you know, long-term career opportunities. And one of these grants is they're looking at training over 1,000 professionals at no charge to those professionals. So we have a lot going on in the training part, so we can bring up the efficiency through projects like the State Energy Program and then train the workforce to meet the, those needs.
I would say another kind of type of green-collar jobs, especially where Utah can make a difference, is going to be more in the professional side and that technology development. And those are going to be the types of jobs where what is Utah's core competency? We have a lot of software programmers. We have a lot of that can work on developing new code and programs to develop the next smart grid and the next different programs associated with that. We also have a lot of material scientists who used to work on the space shuttle and work at Hill Air Force Base, and they can work on developing the next polymer to integrate with solar panels, or chemists who can work on the next biofuels. Those are the types of green jobs that's really going to make a significant improvement in the economy. Because one of the challenges that we're going to have is, especially with some types of green-collar jobs, is as we transition away from traditional fossil fuel-based jobs like workers in coal mines or coal power plants, is a wind technician or isn't going to make as much as someone who worked at a coal mine. I mean, that's what the market is right now. And that's a challenge. And so I think where Utah is really going to be able to contribute is going to be more on that professional and scientific side of it.
And before we go to our audience tonight, I have one more question for the panel, and I want to shake things up a bit here by talking about nuclear energy, because it's a timely issue with the governor expressing some support for looking into nuclear energy with a specific effort to bring a nuclear power plant to the state down in Emery County. Do you view nuclear power as a viable technology for Utah, and do you view it as a green technology or not? Who wants to start? Come on.
Well, from the perspective of the state energy program, nuclear energy certainly has desirable greenhouse gas generation characteristics in the energy generation phase. Our office hasn't looked in detail at the water part of the formula that would be required to viably support renewable or nuclear energy in Emery County. So I guess I would have to say I'm not informed on the details associated with water, is what it boils down to.
I can say that nuclear energy is one of those resources that is evaluated in our integrated resource planning process. And so right now, no decisions have been made. And in terms of that Green River project, I'm not familiar. I haven't read the business plan, so I really can't talk to that project. I'm not informed about it. But in terms of nuclear power in general, we do evaluate it, and right now there is no plans as part of our IRP for it. But it is a technology that should be evaluated. It does, I think it's important to note, it does take, it's a long process to permit a nuclear facility. And I think in light of what's happened in Japan, it's prudent to kind of take a step back and look at what is the, what can we learn from that? That's a very serious situation. And what is the data that's going to come back from that, this kind of tragic event? And so I think what we need to do is kind of take that data, and then that data will help us informed in our decision-making process. But right now, no decisions have been made.
And Utah Clean Energy's position is just that energy efficiency and renewable energy are much quicker and much cheaper and use much less water, and so we think that that's really the way to go, especially for the next 10 years.
Okay, well, now we have time for some questions from our audience this evening. Raise your hand, and we will bring the mic directly to you to ask your question. And please tell us who you are and before you ask your question.
This is Sam Drake. I got to agree, first of all, with about everybody that said probably the best single improvement is conservation. However, I got some other questions that aren't maybe so easy to answer. From James, said that you've got, I think, 1.6 gigawatts of wind energy. That's probably capacity, is that correct?
Yes.
That's capacity. Well, what's the average output?
The capacity factor is about 35%.
That would be a lot higher than I would guess, but...
Because it's mostly in Wyoming.
Usually I've seen that it's considered pretty good if you get 20%, but anyway. And I guess, again, the same thing goes, you state for and states you're going to put in 2.5 megawatts of solar, but again, what's the average capacity on that? I'm going to guess 18%.
You know, I'm looking at Ron Barnes because he's the one installing the system, and actually, I have to apologize. I can't answer that question.
I think I've seen mostly that it's about four, you know, out of a 24-hour day, you're doing pretty good to get 4.5 hours. At rated capacity. So that's about 18%. And so that's basically equivalent to taking two trucks off the road.
And I can't comment. Unfortunately, our environmental manager just had a child, so I'm filling in for her today.
Kennicott, are you still burning coal at your plant? Yeah.
Yes, we are.
But converting to gas, some of it?
Converting 3 of the 4 boilers to gas.
Okay.
In the future?
Yeah, I guess for Pacific Corp, you stated how much wind you were putting in, but how much gas. I'm actually for the gas. I think that's probably a pretty good thing. So I'm not criticizing that, but I mean, you know, what's your capacity on gas?
What we've done in the past?
I think... You know, you drive, you know, a couple of times I've driven up to Portland, Oregon, and you look and you see all these windmills. But if you look close, you know, you see where they're putting in gas-powered plants.
Yeah, I mean, right now we have, in terms of what we own, this is all available. This is public information. You can find that. We have about 6,700 megawatts of coal, about 2,000 megawatts of gas, about 1,000 megawatts of wind, and another 1,000 megawatts of hydro. And now going out into the future, we're going to be adding on predominantly mostly wind and natural gas and energy efficiency, which should contribute like what a coal power plant would contribute.
I guess the other thing, my suggestion for what would probably be best to do overall to encourage conservation would probably be a carbon tax or at least a gasoline tax. But do we have the political will to do that?
Unfortunately, we haven't seen that well to date.
All right, next question.
Hi, my name is Jim Levy. I have a question. It's a little bit of a statement as well as a question, and I'm in the lighting business, and energy conservation, energy efficiency is kind of my soul. And I'm traveling from one end of the state to the other, talking with small businesses and things, and trying to explain to them energy efficiency. Now, Rocky Mountain Power has their financer program, which really is beneficial, but I hate to say it, Rocky Mountain Power doesn't cover the whole state. And then we've got a lot of small business owners, 1 to 2,000, 3,000, up to about 10,000 square feet, that have we are easily 15 years behind the rest of the nation in lighting retrofits in this state. And we got to find some way to help these small business owners do the retrofits in their building to get rid of their T12 lamps and get on to the T8 and T5 like the rest of the country. Has anybody got any comments or help or some sort of direction for the small business owners?
Salt Lake City is looking at a program right now and is going to be putting into place. We do have a small business loan program, and we're going to be expanding that for energy efficiency because we realize that is a need. We've been talking to Rocky Mountain Power about how we could even bridge the gap with some of the grants that they so wonderfully give to some of these businesses. We've actually, as a city, been recipients of that financer program and some of the grants. Another thing that we've been actively doing in the city, and we're, you know, anyone who wants some advice, we're happy to give them, is the energy savings ESCO process, where we're basically doing the retrofit and paying for the retrofit out of the energy savings. So I think there's more and more coming out of that, and I know that the county's program for home energy efficiency, we're, you know, also looking at could we work with them and add some of our business at the same time. So you're right. You know, it is an area that needs some, you know, more attention, and we're trying to give it that attention.
I would also say that for areas that aren't covered by Rocky Mountain Power, you should probably be speaking with UAMPS about opportunities. And all of us have relationships with UAMPS, though they may not be as direct as we would with Rocky Mountain Power, but we'd be happy to speak with you after this.
Idea, and that's the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Energy for America program. They offer 25% grants to rural areas to do energy efficiency or renewable projects, and they have a streamlined grant application for small projects, but it's a once a year, so you have to line up projects and then help them apply once a year.
All right, next question.
Mark Thomas, I'd like to ask the panel about large geothermal projects. Two concerns that I have. Number one, we know we have geothermal resources up and down the state. We don't know quite where the best sites are, and it's going to take a lot of money to find those. It's cheap base energy. Why aren't we exploring? Who pays the millions of dollars to find out where that cheap base energy is my first question. The second question is, there's a first mover advantage to this energy. The last plant, and I'm not an expert in this, I know very little about it, the last plant I saw, though, the energy was going to California. It looks to me like California is willing to outbid us. So by the time when energy gets expensive, we will have lost out on the cheap energy. The first mover advantage is going to California, and we're missing out right now because we're not doing anything. I'd like the panel to address those issues.
In terms of geothermal, we do have a geothermal facility down outside of Beaver, and it was actually came online in 1984, and it was the first geothermal facility outside of California. So we're kind of proud about that. And we did just recently, I believe in 2007, we expanded it. Geothermal is probably, from a utility perspective, is probably the best, quote unquote, renewable energy because it is baseload. It is, it's not intermittent, it's on demand, it's dispatchable. You can use it when you need it. The challenge is to get to that resource, you have to do drilling, just like you'd be drilling for either oil or natural gas. It's kind of a similar process in that sense. And that drilling is expensive. And how we're regulated currently is that there's a concern that if we drilled and we didn't find it, we didn't find the resource, we're going to be stuck with millions of dollars in costs that cannot be passed along. So because of that risk, and utilities are very risk averse, we like consistency, we don't like to invest money that there's not going to get a return on it. So because we're risk averse, that has really put some brakes on doing a lot of the exploration.
The state energy program is funding a lot of geothermal resource identification work by the Utah Geological Survey at present. So there's a lot of work going on in that realm right now. Geothermal development requires ideally a high temperature resource. A lot of Utah's resources are lower temperature, which creates a technology challenge. Developing geothermal also requires favorable geologic faulting circumstances. That's one of the factors that makes the Blundell plant so successful. So identifying the resource is one step, and then the next is identifying the geologic circumstances that allow the working fluid to travel along the heat source and pick up heat from the source and then be extracted and used for energy production.
I was going to add, it's very site-specific, so a property owner really has to go about having a very site-specific survey of their property to determine whether or not you have the actual resource. We've done some significant surveys working with the state energy program to look for geothermal resources along our property, and we just don't have that resource on our property. So it has to be a property owner who's actually willing to go after a site-specific survey as well.
And the second part of his question about power being generated in Utah but going to California, maybe one of you could address. Why does this happen, and what would turn that around?
The average cost of power in Utah is about 5 cents, and California's going to pay 9 or 10 cents.
And California has a very strong renewable energy standard where they are required to have, is it 33%, James? Did they just pass
Yeah,
it?
They did. Yeah,
33% of their energy from renewable energy, and Utah has a renewable energy standard, but it has so many loopholes in it that we're really not required to do anything. We're allowed to use very old renewable energy credits that have no value to anyone else. So part of it are policies.
So then your organization, Sarah, would support stronger mandates. Is that true?
Well, there's always this idea of market versus mandate, but the energy market and the utility market is so regulated that they have a lot of mandates already. So we would support a renewable energy standard for the state because it is not a free market. We have a monopoly and a monopsony. So we have one buyer and one seller. And I think that we could use some guidelines if indeed we want to move more renewable energy forward in this state. And we can still do it in a way that's cost effective and that does not negatively impact rates. Our rates are going up. Our coal plants that we have are fully depreciated. So it's like having a house that's paid for. All new resources are more expensive.
Well, James, can I ask you then, from Rocky Mountain Power's perspective, what a stronger, you know, mandate passed by the legislature mean for your company, and what would be your position on it?
Well, we supported the target, the RPS target that was passed on the Senate Bill 202, which kind of is now set the bar, and we think it's actually been very successful. We've actually met, we're meeting the targets within there, although we have out until the year 2025 to have 20%. But in terms of kind of interim targets, we're on track and we're meeting it. So we think by allowing the company to have flexibility is actually the most cost-effective way to do it versus having kind of stringent mandates. The thing about Rocky Mountain Power and PacifiCorp, and then our owners, Mid-American Energy Holdings Company, we say what we're going to do. And so when we said we're going to add on a bunch of wind, we added on thousands of megawatts of wind. So I don't think having a kind of a hard mandate. I think an RPS as a construct was a tool that was developed, about 10 years ago or 20 years ago. It's really not, in my opinion, I don't think it's the best construct today, now that we're in kind of a new energy paradigm. I think there's other more effective ways to do it. And as Sarah pointed out, we're already regulated. So there's other mechanisms by which you can achieve those goals. I don't think the RPS is necessarily the best mechanism to do that.
Next question.
Hi, this is Christine Wilcox, and I have a couple of questions in regards to an eco-village that I am involved in building. We don't yet have the land, so I don't have any specifics on what resources we would have. What I'm trying to find out is if there is funding for any renewable projects off-grid, so this would be something that is not connected to any utility. And the second part of my question would be, I've heard you guys talk about solar and wind, and that's what we've been looking into as possibilities, but we are hoping to create a space for people to showcase new innovations, and I know that biofuels is a ways out. If anybody knows that they're of any current technologies that are just about to reach the point where they could actually be used in residential communities like an off-grid eco village, I'd be interested to know about those.
The state energy program does administrate a state tax credit for renewable energy. So depending on the ownership structure of the community that you're developing, that may be an incentive that would be applicable to the projects there.
One thing that we've seen at Daybreak is the large scale, couple megawatt wind turbine doesn't really work in a development type scenario, but what does work is process or building specific architectural type wind technology. So if you've ever been out to the southwest side of the valley, it's extremely windy. It may not be windy at the level within the atmosphere to actually utilize a large scale wind turbine, but you can look at some of the smaller, more application-specific type wind that actually does work fairly well to provide a certain percentage of energy on either a residential structure or a commercial building, ground mount and building mount.
And you may want to consider, sorry, this is Ann with Salt Lake County, you may want to consider coming into our USU Extension office to talk about the biofuels program that we're doing. The gentleman that you would want to speak with is Dallas Hanks. He's a great asset to the county.
Any more questions from the audience tonight?
Rob Wilson. It was stated that fossil fuel energy is more expensive at current market rates than renewables. How does it compare when you factor in externalities such as air pollution, global warming, and mining accidents?
I'll start the plug for Sarah. Sarah has been working on that question for a long time and working with the Public Service Commission. We've all been trying to figure out how you calculate those externalities when you're calculating in costs. It is a discussion that the Public Service Commission is open to having and that they continue to have. And if you have ideas on how those concepts can be calculated or data sets, we would all be very interested in talking with you.
As part of future generation for coal, one of the challenges that the utility goes through when we do our resource planning is how do you accurately price coal and how do you accurately price the carbon emissions from that coal? And it's because of that uncertainty that really adds on a high level of risk that we're, as I mentioned before, we're risk averse. And so because of that, we, in our future generation plan, we don't have any coal. Now, what we do in our plan, we do add on what we call a carbon adder. We do develop a cost that is associated with those with the carbon emissions for the fossil fuels. So it is integrated into our modeling. Now, what is that appropriate number? That's a great question that is constantly struggled over, and we do work with our modelists and try to settle with a value that we think does represent as best as we can. But it's really because of that uncertainty, we aren't doing coal in the future.
And with all due respect to Pacific Horn Rocky Mountain Power, we're thrilled and we have been working with them on that carbon adder. But that carbon adder is just the cost of regulation. It's not the cost, the impacts of climate change. It doesn't deal with if we're going to have droughts in the future or health impacts. It's really just the cost of what we think regulation will be. So we really haven't gotten our arms around how you can start valuing the environmental and health impacts of energy use and energy decisions in a constructive way.
Because that's a very hard thing to calculate.
Next question.
Peter Ashcroft. Mr. Campbell had made a reference to some policy tools that might be more effective than an RPS for promoting renewable energy. I was wondering if he or someone else on the panel would like to elaborate about what some of those other more effective tools might be.
Well, one of the things that there's some incentives that different, whether that's at the state level that can do, there's... I would say that encouraging the development of the cheapest resource within renewables should be our priority. One of the challenges, I just read this article that was developed by the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank, and the Brookings Institute. They co-authored this. And one of the things they were talking about, okay, we have the same objective, which is how do we promote clean energy. But what is the best mechanism to do that? Right now, as a society, we have a series of tax breaks, and we have a series of these other RPS mandates. We have a series of these tools that go out to encourage the bringing online renewable energy. But what we really need to do is encourage cheaper renewable energy, and we should harness those kind of social resources. Instead of giving tax breaks, maybe what we should do is invest more in R&D, because right now, really, as a society, we haven't done that significantly. We haven't invested in developing the technologies at the level of the problem that we're facing. And that's really the challenge, because until we can come up with really cost-effective replacements, we're going to kind of be in this quandary. So I would say one better way to look at it isn't having tools to encourage more being brought online, but rather let's have tools that encourage cheaper to be brought online, cheaper renewables, that is.
I would also add to what James just said and say that we need to focus on the R&D specific to battery. How do we capture the energy and how do we keep it consistent over time? One of the issues that we know we're going to run into with our solar project is how do we make it consistent? How do we make it so when a cloud comes overhead or a massive storm that we're able to continue to provide power to our facility?
One more mechanism that I would also consider is in the last integrated resource plan, Utah Clean Energy has been asking the utility to model a solar rebate program to pay a portion of the renewable of the solar resource as an incentive or a rebate to consumers that want to put it on their home. And they did model it. They did two model runs, and they ran two different prices. One was $1,500 per kilowatt. One was $2,000 per kilowatt. They didn't let their model choose very much, but it did choose everything that it could choose for every year that it ran, which shows that if you think about utility resource additions in a little different way and think about, well, if the utility pays for part of the system and then the customer pays for the rest, that is a cost-effective way to drive renewable energy. And the fact that the model selected 1.2 megawatts a year, which isn't that much, we think it would probably select a lot more than that. So we think there are also cost-effective ways to leverage utility money with private money to drive investments.
Any more questions tonight?
My name is Jerry Engel. I'd like to follow up on a comment and get some feedback from the experts on the panel here, a comment that Sarah Wright made, and that is the U.S. and Utah are falling, well, the U.S. in particular now has fallen behind, I believe you said China, and then you also said Germany. And so what is it about the, I'm sure there are economic issues, political issues, educational issues perhaps, and even cultural. I heard that come up a couple of times. But what is it that the U.S. and Utah perhaps are not doing that these other nations are doing that maybe we should, are we looking at what China and Germany have done to leap ahead of us? Do the experts on the panel have any comments on where we might go forward?
Well, in the case of Germany, they have heavily incented investment in renewable energy and particularly photovoltaics with a very progressive incentive approach called the feed-in tariff. And the cost then gets spread across ratepayers and also taxpayers who support the subsidies that come out of the government revenues. So it's a societal decision to move forward as a country with renewable energy development and to pay for it.
You know, one comment about, especially in the context of solar power and China in particular, one thing is that there is not a single solar power manufacturer who uses solar energy to manufacture the solar panels. And if you look at in China, where most of the solar panels, or at least the silicon, is manufactured, it's all manufactured using coal power. And that coal power, and China is building multiple coal power plants like gangbusters. Although they've increased their wind, they're putting a lot of wind on, they're building coal like there's no tomorrow. And so one of the challenges I think we have to look at it is more of a life cycle analysis. I mean, we can shut our coal plants down here, ship the coal, because China right now is buying coal up from the United States, ship the coal over there so they can manufacture solar panels and sell it to us. But I think one of the commonalities between China and Germany, in a sense, is they still do manufacturing. The U.S., we don't really manufacture anything anymore. And so I think that's one of the challenges we're going to have as we look at this. If we want to become players in the green economy, if we want to become players in solar and these others, we have to retool and rethink our manufacturing base.
And in defense of China, I would also add that in the last 5 years, they have surpassed the amount of renewable energy that the United States have installed in the last 30 years. So they may be building coal plants, but they're also building quite a bit of installing quite a bit of renewable energy. China, from what I understand, they're not fighting whether or not climate change is real. And they see that they can have a big piece in this global economic development of clean energy. And the United States, frankly, hasn't decided that we want to go there, that we want to be a player in that world.
Yeah, I think what China's doing is, I think they're looking at, they have to have everything. They have to have multiple resources. And they have so much demand for energy right now, especially. And now China has surpassed the United States. China is the largest greenhouse gas emitter. So as they're building these coal power plants to feed this economy that's been roaring, they're not putting the pollution controls on that we are in the United States and that we're putting on in our coal power plants here in Utah. I mean, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars scrubbing and cleaning the emissions that come out of our coal stacks. And so it is a challenge. I mean, China is like very complex, and I think Sarah's right. I think you can't make it as simple as saying they're doing this or they're doing that. They're doing a lot. And it's and there are some aspects of it where we can learn, and that's where, to kind of go back to reiterate my point, I think one of the things that they've done along with Germany is this: they haven't given up on manufacturing, and I think that's something that we should really look at.
All right, next question.
During the discussion, it came out, I think, that solar power at current is still relatively expensive. And I'm not certain whether that was being measured in that part of the discussion in terms of capacity or potential, as we were talking about before. In that light, why is it beneficial or so beneficial to do these large solar projects that we're working on if it's really that expensive. And also, if I could extend that discussion to wind, I think James mentioned that the wind was getting to the point in some areas of generation where it was competitive with, I think he said, natural gas. Is that also the case with fossil fuels and everything else?
Did you want to answer that? Or?
Well, I'll step in with my two cents first. One thing when you look at solar, if you look at today's prices, what you're paying today for the energy that it puts out today, it is more expensive. But if you look at the life cycle of your solar installation and the rising costs of energy, it pencils out. It's not a big win of, you know, oh, I'm going to make lots of money because I'm going to put in my solar. There are other reasons that you put in solar. But over the long run, because you're buying all your fuel up front in your installation, no fuel costs, it does pencil out.
Well, and it also, solar panels today cost about 50% less than they did, I don't know, a year ago. So the same exact panel that you could buy today, you would have spent twice as much last year.
And I would just point out that the reason for that is because we as a community, as a culture, are making the decision to invest in solar. There isn't enough money going into R&D. So the companies that are getting the money to make the systems that are more efficient are getting that money because people are buying their panels. So we as the county have chosen to invest in solar energy in hopes that for this community in a couple of years it makes it cheaper.
One other thing to just add about that, I think it, at least what we're seeing out at Daybreak, we have one builder who builds two home products that come standard with solar. So he has a certain number of houses that he's going to build within Daybreak every year that comes standard with solar. So if you want that house, you don't get to choose. You go to that builder and you buy that house and it comes standard with the solar. It will take builders like that or companies like that to actually invest in solar up front, bring the need to the marketplace, which will continue to drive down the cost of solar. So that's another thing to consider when you're talking about cost.
Yeah, I would just add one thing is why we're interested in solar is that I think if you look at the computer, look at where the computer was, I don't know, 15 years ago, or, you know, I don't know if anybody remembers when Windows 95 came out, you know, and the type of computer you can get with a 486, you know, and it was a couple thousand dollars, and now my cell phone is more powerful than that. And that it's a very similar technology in the sense it's a silicon base. The difference is we have as a society through Intel and AMD and all these other companies, we've invested thousands and thousands of man hours in developing those products. When it comes to solar energy, we haven't yet invested that. And I think once we do as a society, we should see those costs drop. I don't know if hopefully it'll follow Moore's law, like the computer, you know, every 18 months, the computer gets twice as powerful and half the cost. Will that happen with solar? I don't know, but I think as a utility, we're interested in kind of keeping our eyes open on it. And that's why we really like the Salt Lake County project, because there we can kind of get our feet wet. We can start observing it, but then we're still in the same quandary of, are we the first adopters? You know, are we the first to go out and buy the iPhone when next year, you know, you can get it for half cost? And so should we go out and buy that solar panel right now, put up a big solar array, a huge facility, and in 6 months or a year later, it's cheaper? And so it's when those, and I'm pretty confident that over time that those, it will eventually break that where the costs will come down and that will be competitive. It's just how to time that. That's the struggle. But until we can hit that timing, projects like Salt Lake County and projects that Salt Lake City are doing, I think, do help and add value to that.
Department of Energy has also announced a program recently called SunShot, which is equivalent to the Moonshot program, to bring the cost of solar down to $1 a watt. So the Secretary of Department of Energy, Chu, announced that program, I think, in February.
Sarah mentioned that the cost over time it helps to pay for itself. Do we have an estimate right now on how long solar takes to reach a rough parity?
You know, our numbers are biased because we have grants that are assisting in the formulation of those, so I wouldn't feel comfortable misleading you.
What we've looked at, even over time, it's still a more expensive resource right now. You can look at solar thermal. There's different types of solar projects. We do think it's a matter of time. But right now, when we've evaluated as part of our resource planning, it has not made the cut because we are, by law, we operate under a cost-effective standard. So it hasn't, in our analysis, reached that yet.
And part of what will determine that is whether or not we end up with a carbon tax in the future. We try and calculate that into our hedge as we make the decisions for our systems. But that could be, as we mentioned earlier, 6%. It could be, depending on the year and the request from Rocky Mountain Power, 12%. It could be 2%. We just don't know. So we're guessing like everyone else. We're trying to make educated decisions by working with Rocky Mountain Power to assess that. But it's still a guess.
Since the prices have come down, but we were looking at 25 years at the higher prices.
And I wanted to say, I think in new home construction, it would end up being somewhere around 12 years.
All right, any more questions tonight from the audience?
I was going to ask a question about the nuclear and the carbon footprint of that, but listening to you all talk about the solar, I think you're spouting off a lot of baloney down there. I was involved in a project maybe 30 years ago to build solar greenhouses at the cost of $300 a piece on the sides of houses, south or west sides, of very poor people, and you end up with heat. Salt Lake City has a huge number of south and west facing rooftops. If there was a partnership between Rocky Mountain Electric and whatever governmental authority was necessary, and you installed solar collectors on those rooftops and maintained them, and the homeowners benefited in some small way from it, you would have more peak power than you would ever need because the solar collectors work when you have peak demand. And I'll forget about my nuclear question. I'll ask Sarah privately.
I would just make a comment. As much as I agree with a lot of what you're saying, what we're running into is we're installing as if you're going to hit peak power, you have to make sure that the panels are aligned appropriately. And most of the systems that are installed today aren't. When we're talking about the Salt Palace, that peak is around 5 p.m., and that's just not when we're producing the most solar. Our hope is that our demand charge will be reduced by 10 to 15% through this system. That's our goal. But that's recognizing that we're going to also have to change the way we run our HVAC system, how we run pretty much all of our air handling units. We are going to have to take active changes at the facility to try and meet, to change the time of our peak, even to get the 10% reduction.
And I'll say that solar is definitely during the peak of the day when the power is more expensive. It's just not at the utility's super peak in the evening when everyone comes home and turns up their air conditioner. But it's definitely valuable. And I'd love to see the figures on how you installed it so affordable. So you were doing the passive solar. Is that what you were doing? Which is another extremely cost-effective measure.
Strongly recommend people move to passive power whenever they possibly can. It is by far the best means that people can undertake in order to make a change.
My name is Brad Belknap, and I just want to thank, first of all, the panel for being here. I think it's a really lively discussion, and I really appreciate that. But I want to kind of build on some of the questions that have been asked previously, specifically I'm curious to know why there hasn't been as big of a push for small-scale renewable power, specifically talking about the success of some European countries with feed-in tariffs and other policies that promote incentives for people to themselves look into and begin to build their own small-scale renewable energy that can contribute to the grid as a whole. And that has been proven to be quite successful. So I'm curious to know what efforts are being done to look into small rather than these large plants that cover large areas.
Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City have both talked about how we solve this problem, and we've been trying to figure it out for about, well, since Vicki and I got to the county and to the city, and I'm sure before us. The county worked with Utah Clean Energy to try and do a PACE legislation, which is a model in which there would be loans using bonded funds by a government agency to install renewable energy on local homes. That program has been hopefully temporarily suspended by the federal government to try and figure out some issues that were occurring with Freddie and Fannie. Basically, that people were taking out loans when they may not be able to cover those costs. The county has found a way around that by working with our local investors on the loan program that I mentioned earlier. That loan program does cover renewable energy on homes. So we are trying to figure out that very question. We think it's incredibly important, and if we're going to make significant change, that's where it's going to be. But we're struggling.
You know, in terms of that distributed generation, which is what you're referring to, Rocky Mountain Power, we do offer what's called the net metering, where you can sell, we'll buy it back from you, the production that you don't use. And we also do provide some solar incentives, a rebate. But and you did mention the feed-in tariff. I think, you know, one thing that we're learning about in Europe, especially in Spain, with the feed-in tariff is that Spain's economy has really struggled and taken a big hit. You've had investments and investment banks really pull out of buying up the solar and investing in the solar projects there. And the main reason is because they're recognizing that these feed-in tariffs, which provide a very generous payment, are not sustainable, especially when you have really difficult economic conditions. So it's just kind of a warning sign that we really should, you know, that approaching it from a cost-effective standpoint is still a pretty practical way. And the feed-in tariff, which will bring solar online. There's no doubt about it. It will. The problem is it at what cost? And again, it's still trying to find that sweet spot of how much can we absorb and then how much can we bring on.
Just add that Utah Clean Energy has worked with many of the partners at this table to improve our net metering. Just 3 or 4 years ago, there's a national report called Freeing the Grid, and Utah had an F on net metering and an F on interconnection. And this year, Utah was one of two states in the nation to get two A's, one on net metering and on interconnection. So we've done quite a bit of work there. And going back to the idea that I spoke about before and to James' idea of doing things cost-effectively, that's one of the reasons that we've been working with the utility to model a solar rebate program, because if we can show that it's cost-effective to the utility, that compared to adding other resources for them to give an incentive to the consumer, then we think that's a way that could be a win-win for all parties.
State incentive tax credit for renewable energy and distributed systems of $2,000 has steadily become a greater percentage of the cost of installing those systems as they have come down in price over the past several years also. So that's a positive trend as the market becomes more competitive and technology brings the capacity to the consumer at a lower price. So there are some positive dynamics in place that are making distributed energy less expensive already.
You're listening to a panel discussion on clean energy in Utah, part of the Nature of Things lecture series from the Utah Museum of Natural History here on 88.3 and 105.3 FM, NPR Utah, KCBW. Let's take a couple more questions this evening.
I'm Ron Barnes. I'm the project developer for Bella Energy here in Salt Lake, and we're working with Salt Lake County on the project on the Salt Palace. And I just wanted to back up some information that this gentleman asked about the Salt Palace project and its efficiency. The project will generate 3.5 million megawatt hours of electricity a year, which is equivalent to 25% of the building's usage per year. And a lot of that generation will happen, as Ann pointed out, late in the afternoon and the evening when peak generation is needed. And that's equivalent to 500 houses in Utah. The other, I think, thing about this project that was part of Salt Lake County's decision is that there's a community benefit piece, and that really is part of the Salt Palace's mission as the leading convention center in the state, and that the solar array on the roof will be a wow factor, and it'll attract more conventions and national conferences to the facility each year, and so that will increase the jobs and traffic for the Salt Palace because of the array on the roof. And in fact, the county has actually built an observatory on the roof so that people can go up to the roof and stand there and look at the 11,350 solar modules that'll be on the roof.
A couple more quick questions.
Getzelman, and my question's addressed to James. I've heard a lot about clean coal, and could you explain to me what that is and if PacifiCorp uses it?
I think what clean coal refers to is really more the advanced technologies today. So most of our coal plants that are online in the United States were built really either in the early 70s or the early 80s. And so so there hasn't been a whole lot of coal plants built since then. And so clean coal refers to bringing on these new advanced technologies that as the industry has developed over time, to bring those to bear to where they're much more efficient. So the levels of emissions are much more reduced compared to the existing coal fleet that we have. And, you know, one of the interesting challenges is, you know, is a question that's out there is, do you retire an older plant and replace it with one of these newer ones where the net of that would be less emissions? And so, and then there's also some people lump in the clean coal with that, the carbon sequestration, which is basically the capturing of the exhaust stream from when you burn it, compress it down into a liquid, and then pump it a couple thousand feet into the ground into these like salt domes, and it'll stay there where there's already naturally occurring CO2, and so now you've sequestered the carbon in there. So, but I think clean coal means different things to different people. But that's how I would define it. That's another, like, for example, if you were to do carbon sequestration, what you would do is you would gasify, because one of the biggest challenges is you want a very high pure CO2 stream. So in coal gasification, you do that, you break it up to where then you have a very rich CO2 stream. So then it's much easier to then pump that into the ground. So that'd be one component of it.
Next question, ma'am. I apologize.
This is Mary Ann Wright, and my question goes back to some of the discussion we were just having about China, and maybe it's a global cultural question, but I'd like to see what some of the panel members think about the assertion that the reason that China has gone way ahead of the U.S. on solar manufacturing is that China is content to take technology that exists, and there's a tremendous amount of solar technology that has been developed, and run with it and go with it and make tons of it. Whereas the U.S. has this sort of hang-back idea of we need to keep perfecting this technology. We need to put more in R&D. And so we're just hanging back there. And I'd just be interested in the panel members' thoughts on that. Thank you.
I could say about that, and I agree with you, you see the manufacturing occurring overseas is we're probably, once we start manufacturing, at a disadvantage because of the salaries and the overall cost of manufacturing. So once something is brought to market, we're seeing more and more of it go to someplace like China because they can do it cheaper. And we can't, I won't say it's right that they do it cheaper, but they do. And it has to do with the fact that they do pay quite a bit less. And, you know, that's going to be a disadvantage we are at.
The one thing I would have to add there, though, is even though China's manufacturing a lot of panels, we also have a lot of panels being made here in the United States as well. And it's not that the panel that you buy that came from China is any cheaper than the panel that you buy. They still charge you pretty much, an installer will charge you almost the same amount for either or panel. You just have to try to be an educated consumer and decide where you're going to source your panel from. But it's the same technology we have. Their installers are charging about the same amount for a panel that was manufactured in the U.S. versus a panel that was manufactured in China.
We have the same problem in terms of manufacturing for even for wind. About 60% of the wind components all come from overseas. And most of, for solar panels, most of the actual silicon itself comes from China. It's manufactured in China, and then it's sent over here, and then it's assembled here in different locations throughout the U.S. And same with a lot of the wind, too. It's manufactured overseas and then sent over here, and then it's assembled right before it gets put up. But I think that's a kind of a broader, larger question or that we have. Do we only want to have an information-based economy, or do we want to have a more broader-based? And I think it kind of goes right to the root of that.
Let's see if we can get two more questions here in tonight.
Hello. My question is probably for James. My name is Greta DeYoung, and I've heard about time-of-day rates in other places, and I believe we do have it here as an opt-in program, and I was wondering, was there ever any consideration of having that be just generally available, or somehow getting more people to find out about time of day rates?
Well, it is available right now. So if you want to do it, you can. It's always a challenge to, you know, how do you communicate all the different tariffs that are available. But if you do go to our website, you can find it. I think one of the challenges with it, it really comes down to, and I think some would say this is a good challenge, but because the power is relatively cheap, most people don't opt for it, because they like the convenience of having power on demand whenever you want it. And so as part of that time of use, it really changes that dynamic. But those who are really inspired to do it, it's there available. And if you do change your consuming patterns, you can really benefit financially.
It seems like, you know, if we have problems with peak generation, that if lots of people did that, it would really help the whole system.
It would. And you know what else would be? We also have another program called Cool Keeper, which we unfortunately, we don't have as much participation that we really should. And that's a good program. What that does is, in the middle of the day when we have during this peak demand, we can regulate all the different air conditioners to where you really don't observe it as a customer when you have this put on there. But what it does is it can modulate that, so it can help bring down that demand during that peak time. So that would be a good program that I'd recommend. I do participate on it, and I've never once experienced it impacting me. And you get a $20, you do get compensated for it, so.
There's no talk of it being mandated?
Well, we did support a bill in the last legislature, not this one that just passed, but a year ago, that had it be that all customers would participate in this program, in the Cool Keeper program, and then if you did not want to participate, you had to opt out. And we supported that, and that would have really increased participation. But I think due to
the feeling in the legislature that this is kind of a freedom, you know, it impinged on personal freedoms and liberties and stuff. So I don't think there wasn't a support in the, although it passed the legislature, the governor ended up vetoing it.
One more question this evening. Up there, okay.
What about the very great opportunity to improve the building codes of homes and businesses in Utah and the refusal of the legislature to enact that?
Utah is behind on our building code. There was every 3 years, our building code is, the national building code is updated, and we were able to adopt the code for the commercial buildings, but there was quite a bit of pushback from the builders to adopt the residential code. So consequently, people that buy new homes right now are paying on average $175 more per year on energy costs than they would pay if we did adopt the most current code. So we are continuing to work on that, trying to get the information out, and hopefully next year there will be enough support and understanding that it really makes sense for Utah to adopt up-to-date building codes.
One thing that Salt Lake City is doing is we do give preference in permitting and assistance to any businesses that come in and apply for licenses and as they're building commercial buildings. And if they meet the LEED Silver Standard, we will give them permitting preference. And that's something that we first started it and had very few takers, and it now seems like a large majority of the buildings coming through the system really, you know, they are looking at these additional energy efficiencies and meeting the LEED leadership and environmental or in energy and design standards, and in that way they're really finding that they're going to have a lot of long-term savings as they, you know, over the life of the building. So Salt Lake City is actually looking to see for our own buildings, you know, we're trying to do quite a bit more and more, but we would even are considering going to LEED Gold for our as a standard for all of our buildings.
All right. Thanks for joining us for tonight's panel discussion on clean energy, part of the Utah Museum of Natural History's Nature of Things lecture series. A big thanks to all our participants tonight and to everybody listening on KCBW at 88.3 and 105.3 FM. Now we'll close with Lisa Thompson from the Utah Museum of Natural History.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you very much for being here this evening and leading us through this fascinating discussion. And won't you please join me in thanking the panel for being here tonight with all their expertise. I also want to thank all of you for coming tonight and asking such fascinating questions. And thanks again to all the sponsors and partners who make the Nature of Things possible. We're getting to work on the Nature of Things 2012, so we hope we'll see you next spring back at the library for another interesting round of discussions. Thank you.